You're listening to a Tabletop Game Talk side chat, where we go in depth on a game or topic that's just too big to fit on our regular show. If this is the first time with us, be sure to check out our weekly episodes every Tuesday, wherever you listen to your podcasts, on YouTube, or on our website, tabletopgametalk.com. Now, let the side chat begin. Hi, this is Chris, and I'm here with Nate.
Hey!
And Manny.
Hello!
From the Dice Throne Kickstarter, Season 2. And I guess really part of Dice Throne Season 1 as well, right? So,
yeah.
Okay. Yep.
So, listeners that have listened to me before know that I'm actually quite a fan of this game. It is a top contender. So, we just talked about the 10x10 challenge. And I think this is going to go on my 10x10 challenge list, just to make sure I get great 10 of these games in. So, yeah, I was really, really, like, this is one of, I don't know, I probably back 60 or so Kickstarters a year, and this was one of my favorites that I've gotten in the past 6 months. So,
yeah, I promise we are not paying you to say that.
You're not. And I get no special, well, I'm going to ask you about the promo cards later, but I'm getting no payment for this whatsoever. I just saw that you were doing a season two, and I said, all right, I want to talk to you guys about this whole season two thing, because you've made a ton of changes in season two from season one.
We have indeed, yep.
Yes. Yep. But those who are maybe haven't listened to me talk about Dice Throne before, why don't you guys do a really quick, what is this game, how does it play, and how is it different than other games of its genre, which I guess would be the one-on-one dueling genre?
Sure, yeah. So Dice Throne, it's a fast-paced battle game. Reviewers compare it to King of Tokyo meets Magic the Gathering. So it's definitely a step up from King of Tokyo in terms of what you're able to do, but a step down from how hard it is to get the barrier of entry is much lower than Magic the Gathering. And it's much easier to get to your table. But the core of the game is use a Yahtzee roll or a King of Tokyo roll. You get three rolls total, and then you're going to use your dice outcome to activate one of your abilities on your hero board. Now, the base game in Dice Throne Season 1 came with six unique heroes. There's a Barbarian and the Moon Elf and the Shadow Thief and Pyromancer and Paladin and Monk. And they all play and feel very, very different from one another. And the goal is to get your opponent's life down to zero before they do that to you. And the game plays very, very fast. It's 20 to 40 minutes to play. But where it gets really interesting with Dice Room is the deck of cards. So you can play cards to, you start with four and you gain one more card every turn. And you can play these cards to either upgrade your ability. So there's some light RPG mechanics in the game. Or you can play cards to surprise your foes. So you might play like dice manipulation cards to help your own dice to get closer, hitting your ultimate ability or something. Or you could play cards that can mess with your opponent's dice. Or Dice Throne is actually not just a 1v1 game. It actually plays very, very well in team games as well. It plays 1v1, 2v2, 3v3, 2v2v2, or free-for-all for up to six players. But my personal favorite way to play is a 2v2 match. It's very fun to be able to strategize with your teammate and like, okay, I've got a card that can make any two dice wild. You have a card that can make any one die wild. Let's combine these together and let's help you to hit your ultimate. So it's very fun. And the balance between luck and strategy, in my opinion, is perfect. It's really fun, fast game.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think, I don't want to make it seem like it's just a 1v1. But you can, I mean, in the box that you get six heroes, you can play, you know, that 3v3, that six player free-for-all, or three separate games of 1v1 and have your own little mini tournament if you want to, right?
Yeah, we really built the game around one-on-one and two-on-two. I mean, that's how we started. And then the free-for-all was is another mode of play. But I think when we were figuring out our balance and all that kind of stuff, it was all based around one-on-one, two-on-two.
Yep. Now, one of the things I think is funny, because it's sort of King of Tokyo meets Magic, is a pretty apt description, just to kind of get you in the right mindset. Not at all how the game plays. There's no big Godzilla monsters or anything like that. And Magic, there's no deck building either, which I think is a strength of this game. So I have a few other dueling type games, and you still have to create the deck, and you have to think about what you're doing ahead of time. This is this character, here's your deck, here's your board, here's your dice, go for it and have a good time doing it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we specifically wanted, it's fun, like we get messages all the time from guys who say, I found a game that my wife will finally play with me and she's not a gamer. You know, thank you so much for this. And I really enjoy that. We like that the barrier of entry, both in terms of, you know, how experienced is the gamer, but also in terms of how easy it is to get to the table. I mean, they, each hero has their own little tray. You just pull out their tray and you're ready to go. So it's fast to get to the table, it's fast to play, and it has a low barrier. But at the same time, as you play it more and more, you realize that there's actually a pretty substantial amount of strategy based on, okay, I'm, for example, if I'm the barbarian against the Shadow Thief likes the long game because he's going to poison you, and the he gets stronger the, you know, the longer it goes. So if I'm the barbarian, I better not spend any of my energy trying to heal. I want to crush you as fast as I possibly can. So there's both, you know, overall strategy and tactics from turn to turn as well.
Yep. And you even have a kind of a complexity level on each character. So if you are getting a non-gamer to the table, you can hand them that barbarian and say, okay, let's start the game here. And once you figure out the mechanics and you understand what's going on, then we can switch you over to, you know, the paladin or, you know, one of these other a little bit more complex characters. But none of them are like super complex. It's just, you know, the number really is kind of the number of status effects that you have to pay attention to that change the complexity. Or is there some other something you put in the equation?
Yeah, when we were thinking about complexity, I mean, part of it is how many things are there to think about? How many choices are you presented with every time you're about to roll your dice, when you're looking at your cards, your board, etc. And then also when you look at like the paladin, I mean, he's a harder hero to play. He doesn't have a basic attack. He relies on a passive ability. You know, heroes like the barbarian are roll your dice, see what happens. So the closer the hero is to the roll your dice, see what happens mindset, the simpler they are, the less complex they are. That doesn't mean that you can't play strategically with those heroes. They're just less complex.
Yep. And another thing that really helps us get to the table, the art in this game is phenomenal. And the presentation, like the quality of the components, the dice, every character has a custom set of 5 dice with symbols on it. Even the dials, which I'm not a huge dial fan, but I really like these dials. They're not too tight. They're not too loose. You know, the health dial is a 0 to 99. Your combat dial, which your combat points, which we'll get to in a moment, you know, is just a simple, you know, spin to count. Where did the inspiration for the art come from?
You know, it was kind of fun. When we first started, before it was ever a board game, it was an app. Nate had come up with an idea to use a Yahtzee style mechanic in an app, and it had a fantasy. We kind of dreamt up this idea that it was like this action-y RPG thing, and I started making art for that. And then once it got converted over to being a board game instead, I kept the aesthetic, but I also wanted to draw a little faster because we were both working at. Well, we actually got laid off, but there wasn't a lot of time. So the art was kind of created out of a need to work quickly. And so the art was born out of necessity to design this kind of clean, crisp, very, very, very few lines, but with hard shadows and kind of people refer to it like an American anime kind of thing, almost like Avatar or Airbender thing. But that's kind of where it was born. It was kind of born out of necessity and then just a desire to draw sweet pictures, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I love the style. I love the art. I actually have the Shadow Thief t-shirt. I'm just like, yeah, this is cool. You could wear that anywhere. And people are like, wait, whoa, what's that from? I'm like, oh, yeah, let me tell you about this game.
Thank you.
And then you went. So this is kind of a change between season 1 and season 2. So season 1 had no art on the card fronts. They were color coded. So again, making it very easy to get to the table, you know, the color of the card is going to, you know, have the same type of effect based on the color of the card. And now I guess we can get into when you first did season 1, you didn't have a publisher. You were self-publishing, correct?
Right.
And then in season 2, explain.
Yeah, that all changed quite a bit. So Man and I both have an app ground background, as he said, in app development, video game development. But we're new in terms of, you know, creating board games. Now Manny has created a number of Kickstarters for comic books. So he's not new to Kickstarter, but we were both new to kickstarting a board game and creating a board game. And that was quite the learning curve. And so we did it, and we raised 181 grand. We unlocked every stretch goal we could have imagined. We were humbled and thrilled and blown away by the response to the game. And thankfully, the fan base just became more and more rabid, and we started to realize, man, that, you know, this has legs. This brand can go a long ways, and we always thought it did. But you know, sometimes you can think your game is really great, but the real test is when the strangers get it. You know, what do they think? And so we started to realize that no, this really does have legs. And what we wanted to do, we kind of came up with a 10-year plan. And we had, you know, we have plans for, I want to release 50, maybe even 100 heroes someday. They're all very different and very self-contained. And we had a bunch of game modes. We want to release a co-op version in season 3, hopefully. We'd like to maybe have an arena battle version someday with minis. You know, they all play with the same components. Every game is standalone and every game is cross-compatible. And as we dreamt all this up, we thought, man, we just can't do it with just Manny and I. There's not enough hours in a day. And so then kind of enter Roxley. And Manny could talk about that.
Yeah, it was crazy. Like Nate said, when we jumped into board games, I mean, I know for myself, I was not a massive board game player. I play tabletop miniatures. That was kind of where I came from when it came to playing games. But we had heard of Roxley. We had heard of Santorini, Steampunk Rally at that point in time. They hadn't released Brass when we first kind of got introduced to them or figured out who they were. And then when I remember Nate and I were talking about, well, if we were going to have a publisher, who would we want to take our baby and run with it? And we were like, boy, no, it sure seems right now like nobody cares for their games like Roxley does. I mean, right. they Gavin Brown especially, that dude just pours his life into the art and the design, the gameplay, the mechanics, the rules, every aspect of the game. And we're like, wow, wouldn't it be sweet? I wonder if that dude would take a hold of our game and help us. And sure enough, he was interested. And I think we have started a pretty amazing relationship so far.
Yeah, I can say Santorini, I mean, if you look at that game, which is just a simple abstract game, but mm-hmm. once they got their hands on it, the presentation of that game is phenomenal. You cannot put that on a table and let somebody walking by will be like, whoa, what are you doing? What is that? I want to be involved in whatever you're touching. And it sounds like they've done a number of things, kind of like helped you guys. Even the initial presentation was fantastic, but now you're adding a number of not new components, but modifications to the components. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, it started with, you know, the first thing Gavin said, he's like, man, I love Manny's art style. And I personally agree with him. I think Manny's brilliant at what he does. And I think he kind of breaks the typical mold of what you see in a board game specifically. And so we love it. And Gavin said, why are you covering up, you know, his art with these ability boxes? And we both felt like, well, you need to, because we want the game to be compact. We like that the cards fit perfectly in the upgrade spots. So it just made sense, you know? And Gavin said, no, I'm going to figure out a way to show Manny's art. And we both, honestly, we doubted him. But he did it. It's fantastic. Now with the big art in the middle, the abilities on the side, the trifold board makes it nice and compact. I mean, it works really well. And then, you know, once we started there, he said, well, now we're going to put full art on all the cards as well. And we thought, there's not really room for that. And we actually love the color coding system we had was intentional. It was not a haphazard thing. We liked that it was very clear, like this card can be played in this phase or whatever, as you said earlier. It helped the gameplay. And the new art that he's made, it still has that. With the border colors and how it is, it's very obvious when you can play the card. But it also looks sweet, and the text still feels great on there. And it's almost like a puzzle piece. You can match just the image and know, oh, this upgrades this ability because, you know, the image is the same on both. So that really helped. And then the last thing he wanted to change was the dice.
Yeah, the dice. I am a dice nerd. I'm a hardcore dice nerd. And one of the biggest issues when we set out to make Dice Throne was dice clarity. When you roll those dice on the table, I want you to immediately look across and see what it is. I've played way too many tabletop games where miniatures games where guys have these ridiculously complex dice. You can't read. You can't see them. And I did not want that for our game. And so when we set out that nice white, bright, you know, pip or symbol on a cool color was enough. And then Gavin's like, let's color code these dice. And my stomach kind of sunk a little bit because I was like, oh, you're going to make them harder to read. They're going to be less easy to for people to track with. Plus, you're gonna the colors are gonna get wrecked. And he was like, just let me try. And he did it. And to Gavin's credit, once more, he was all like, see? And we rolled those in Tabletop Simulator. But instantly, I could track symbols and colors to the abilities based off the dice. And we've been exploring some of the swirl patterns and colors and how the dice will look. And they look really nice.
Yeah,
they look really, really nice. And I continue to be impressed over and over again with what Gavin does, what Roxley does. And the dice are, you know, just one more instance of how cool, how much coolness they have added to the project.
Yeah.
And it's really cool to see. Oh, go ahead. You go, Chris.
Yeah, I would say that it's not common to see dice that have different colored sides. So, because I'm with you, you know, the symbols are nice and clear. If we start putting colors on the dice, you know, is it going to look right? But if you can pull off the different colored sides, it just reinforces those symbols. And, you know, you always have that issue where if you're relying on color, then you have the colorblind issue of gaming. But you also have those symbols to reinforce it. And the colors, they don't look muted to me in any way. Like, they still pop off the die. So you kind of got the best of both worlds in there. I'm really excited to see them and have them in my hands.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, it'll be really fun. We started playing in Tabletop Simulator, and the truth is, Dice Frame plays best because it's a fast game. And some of these tweaks that Gavin made just make it that much faster to be able to read your dice, understand new heroes, everything else. We really like it. And Gavin has said many times, I think one of the things I really like is that we have a really solid mutual respect in our team. And so particularly with, you know, me, Manny, and Gavin, the team of Dice Throne is big. There's actually a number. It's growing fast. But obviously, we were the core of the team, and we all respect our different little pieces that we do, and it works really, really well in what we're doing for the future.
Yeah, well, I'm really excited for you guys because it means that I get to see more of this. So when I first played this, one of the things that I came away with it immediately was, I want this to be my character in my role-playing game. The way that the characters like level up, and I'm using that air quotes, but it's not really like, because you have 8 different abilities. All of them can be level 2'd and level 3'd. You have different cards you can play to affect your dice and, you know, like you say, your surprises and things like that. But just the combat role, and, you know, I call it the Yahtzee mechanic versus the King of Tokyo mechanic, but I guess it's just generational. But that idea where it's like, okay, I'm going to try. I'm going for a certain ability, but if I don't get that, I can have this fallback ability that I can use. And then that mechanic, but then the beauty of it is the opponent or whoever you're fighting, you know, Monster X, is going to get a defense roll, but they don't have the Yahtzee mechanic. They just get a straight roll and you see what you get, which speeds things up really fast. And I'm just like, I could totally see myself running an adventure where the players were these characters, and I'm just rolling the defense dice for the monsters, and maybe the defense dice vary depending on the monster. If they're a higher level, I add a couple more dice or something like that. Like, that's where my head goes, and that's how much I feel like part of these characters when I'm playing them. So
that's awesome.
Anyway, season 4.
Well, yes, I love it. Actually, I mean, honestly, Chris, though, I think one of the things that really helps this game to resonate with people is because what we've created is not necessarily a game as much as it really is a sandbox.
Yep.
And we get to build and play and dream. And I love that it invites our community to do the exact same thing. We have a very, very, if you go to community.dicerun.com, we have a phenomenal community group. If you ever have a rules question, you'll get an answer literally in minutes flat. People post pictures all the time of themselves playing. People are like hosting games. We've never asked anyone. And people are scheduling like, hey, I'm going to be at this game store teaching all these new players and blah, blah, blah. Like, it's become, Gavin said, you guys are like creating like a fanatical, almost religion of people who love this game so much. And it's been cool to see how it's come to life. But one of the things that for sure is there is like what you just did of taking what we've created and dreaming up a new mechanic for it. It's like rampant in that group. And we love that, right? Yeah. And so people are like, what if we made a hero like this? And what about that hero? What about this game mode? And people, you know, at PAX South, someone said, we played this game where we played the Paladin and he had like twice as much life. And it was, you know, the Paladin versus everybody else. And he had all these upgrades in play and it was 1v5, right? And I love that people are just doing that and dreaming. It's really, really fun to see.
Yep. Well, yep. One of the things I think this also brings, because there isn't this metagame of deck construction and chasing the rarest cards or coming up with the best formulas. Like, I really love Dice Masters. I think it's a great game. But it's net deck to death, where it's like, okay, here are the five decks that are going to win. And by decks, I mean, here are the eight cards you need.
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. But it leads to, and Dice Masters is one of the most friendly tournament communities I participated in. But it leads to a very competitive, almost like confrontational style of gaming, where with Dice Thrones, you're not doing that. And you do have a decent amount of randomness. And it's just, it's fun to play. And you're just trying mm-hmm. to optimize those plays. And win or lose, you had a good time. And you felt like, and this is my favorite part of games, especially with games with randomness, you didn't blame yourself for losing. You blame that darn roll of the die, or I didn't draw the right card.
Yes.
And that's a great feeling, because you feel like you could have won if only, and you want to play again.
Yeah. It's interesting. Today, last night, I was playing with my mom, my seven-year-old, and my wife. And I'm pretty sure my mother has never played a fantasy role-playing combat game in her life. And she initiated because she enjoys playing this. And my seven-year-old strategically played his entire game by himself. It was a 2v2, so it was me and him. He made all his own choices. And my wife has never yet played any of my highly strategic miniatures-based war games. And she came out earlier asking me a question about a rule. She was like, okay, I'm in playing with mom right now. What about this? And the fact that my mother, wife, and seven-year-old all want to play Dice Throne just desperately, like they're hungry to play this game, says that it bridges gaps unlike probably any game that I have ever played.
Yeah, for a one-on, well, I keep saying one-on-one, but for a competitive game like this, it just kind of drives that I want to play again.
Yep.
Yeah. And so, the fact that it's so fast furthers that, right? Because if you do lose, a lot of the gut reaction is like, dang it, re-rack, like, let's play again right now because I'm gonna beat you this time.
Yep. Know?
yeah my wife would go on dates. She would say, okay, we're gonna go to McDonald's, we're gonna get a dollar Coke, we're gonna share it, and I'm gonna play Shadow Thief until I beat you. And an hour and a half or 2 hours later, we would have played like six or eight games in that time period. And then when she wins, she's all like, yeah, okay, we're done. Let's go home, watch a movie or something.
Yep. So, and what that does is drive people to want to play more and more characters, right? So you have six characters in season one. Season two starts with six. So season one started with four, two for Kickstarter stretch goals. Mm-hmm. Season two starts with six. Potentially two. At least one's been unlocked now and the other one's been hinted at. So we have seven currently, possibly eight. What are some of the new characters, like new mechanics, new things that you're excited to get into the community hands?
Yeah, one of the things that I specifically, a goal of mine is that every season I want to break the status quo. I don't want there to be a status quo. And when people start like assigning one, that makes me even more want to do something different than that. And so a few things that we've done this season was one of the things, like with the cursed pirate, she starts with three cursed doubloons. And at the end of every turn, you have to remove one. If you ever have to remove one and there's none left to be removed, then you become cursed and you have to flip your entire hero board over and you go from the pirate to the cursed pirate. And she's this really beautiful, you know, glowy skeleton looking version of it. And all of her abilities change. She gets way stronger, but she self-inflicts 5 damage every turn because she's cursed. And she curses the whole table. So she has a passive that says, if anyone does not attack on their turn, then they get inflicted with this thing called a powder keg. So it forces like everybody at the table was just fighting constantly now. And so we try to do things like that, right? Where like the artificer builds these, he's kind of this weak old man, but he builds these robots and then the robots become his army for him. And so although he's weak, if you let him go too long, he builds up his robot army and you're going to lose. So that's really fun. Then we have the Huntress, who's like really, really tied to her pet. She has this awesome saber-tooth tiger that she plays with. And so they all have their thing, but we tried to figure out how can we break the status quo. Like even the number of cards in every deck, we've changed that. I don't want, in season one, every single deck had exactly 32 cards. And now we're changing that. And it further affects game balance from hero to hero. And there's so many things that we haven't revealed yet that I would love to tell you right now, but we have so many ways that we will continue to break the status quo in this game.
Well, I'm going to take that as a promise. Speaking of cards, you have a number of promos, and I haven't looked at the promos, but I'm kind of curious, how do promos work in this game? Are they going to be added to your deck? Are they can be added anywhere? Are they, you know, modifiers, global rule modifiers? Like, what do these promos do?
You want me to answer?
Sure.
I was just taking turns. Go ahead.
So, what we wanted to do, especially with promo cards, is the promo cards cannot be essential. They cannot be a card that if you don't have it, then you're going to lose, or that you have less game to play or less options, right? So what we wanted to do is create special fun cards for the promos. Now, we're not going to get into the details of what those are at the moment, but it was thing we want to label a promo. Like we did a promo pack for season one that was just new art on the wild card, the So Wild. Now, those are super fun and people love them. But again, not necessary, just a fun addition.
Right.
And so what we're doing right now is we're going through and adding these one-off cards into the campaign. And they add flavor and they add fun and they add... So if I back up a second, one of the things when we started is we both wanted a dynamic game. We have embraced the dynamicness of dice. And so when we add in these cards, we want it to further embellish that dynamic play. So I don't know if you want to add anything to that, Nate.
We could tell them like what the barbarian card is. Should we do that?
Sure.
Okay, but this is breaking. We haven't actually revealed what his card does yet. So
all right.
Here you go. So his promo card is called Adrenaline Surge. And so, again, everything that we share is subject to balance change. We're doing math. It's like the 80-20. We spend 80% of our time in the last 20% of this game for balance reasons. We've really spent a massive amount of energy on balance in this game. But his card is called Adrenaline Surge, and it costs 0 combat points, so you can play it for free. You roll one die, and if it's a 6, it's kind of like a Hail Mary card. In this case, if it's a 6, you can stun any opponent at the table, which is like really, really good that you can do that. But the chances of hitting it, right, you have to roll a 6. So alternatively, you can choose to just discard that card and draw another card in its place. So it's not vital to your deck. It's a total Hail Mary. But if you're on the ropes, it's like a comeback chance. You know, you have an option.
I love it. Yeah. And it's one of those things. And because you can discard and draw, it doesn't even take up a space in the deck, technically speaking.
Exactly.
Yep. Yep.
That is awesome. So let's see. We've talked about your future plans, season 3. I won't get too much into it because obviously it's quite a ways from here. But you guys aren't stopping at season 2. At least you're not planning to stop at season 2. What about tournaments and things like that? Are you guys going to be sponsoring tournaments at conventions? What is your plan for organized play-esque systems? Anything there?
Yeah, so we actually had, we hosted our first ever convention. It was called Dice Throne Con, and we had it a few months ago, and it went very, very well. And we would hope to be able to do more of those. We'll see what happens. It's definitely it's not a money-making convention for us at all. It's just a fun celebration is what it was. But we had 42 people show up, and we hosted the first ever Dice Throne tournament. Or no, we had a lot more than that show up. There's 42
people. 75.
We had 75 people there, but 42 people entered the tournament. And so that was really, really fun. And one of the guys on our team, Aaron Hine, hosted that tournament and drafted the first set of tournament rules. We worked on these together. But the idea is you pick 2 heroes to enter the tournament with, and those are your heroes for the rest of the game or the rest of the tournament. And you can, at the start of a match, you see what your opponent's 2 options are, you know what your 2 options are. You both reach under the table, you pick 1 die from either hero, and then you both reveal your hand above the table at the same time. And that tells you, you know, which hero each of you are playing. And then whoever loses round one can, it's a best of 3. Whoever loses round one can pick either hero they want for the next one. But whoever wins must play the other hero in their list. So it creates a lot of diversity. It's very fun. Nobody could pick like one hero and try and coast the whole tournament through. But it went fantastic. And it showed that Dice Throne is a game of both strategy and luck. It's not just luck, right? The night before the tournament, actually, a buddy asked me, who do you think is going to win? And I named one person, Adam. And sure enough, he did. He was exactly, out of 42 people, he was exactly the guy that won. So I like that, obviously, luck is a factor, but also it proves that strategy is a factor as well.
Did you come away with any feeling of, because you're always, in a game like this, balance is always a tricky thing, right? So your first tournament, that one's got to be a little scary because, like, all right, is one of these characters going to come out on top as, like, the runaway competitive player? Any of that or, like, you know, anything where he's like, maybe in the next, you know, set of characters, we need to pay attention to this or that aspect of things. How did that turn out?
Yeah, one of the things that's interesting is, so all of our heroes, we talk about the complexity rating, right? And what that really means at the end of the day is that someone who masters that hero, let's call it, will be able to play that hero at a very, you know, effective level of play. And so if someone, what we find frequently is with the, let's say we have a complexity 5 or 6 hero, which is the top of our scale, it's based on a dice. We have two responses. One is that the brand new players will play that hero and often say, this hero is underpowered and they suck because they're complex to play well with. And then you have people who play them very well and other people will say, this hero is overpowered, right? He's way too strong because they played them very well. And part of the strategy is learning how to play against those very complex heroes. And so we worked so hard to not have any overpowered heroes. The Shadow Thief is clearly my favorite hero, absolutely. And Manny's is the Barbarian. And what I love about that is the Barbarian is our complexity 1 hero, and the Shadow Thief is our complexity 5. And so even at different ends of the spectrum, we both have our favorites. And I feel like everyone is equally viable, but you have to play them differently based on who you're playing against.
I like it. All right, let's get a little bit into the actual Kickstarter itself. So there's a number of funding levels, and this is one of those things. If someone's new to Kickstarter, you start looking at it, it's like, well, wait a minute, which level do I pledge for? What do I want? How am I going to choose? So I'm just going to go over these real quick. We have the Season Pass, which is this season, right? So you get all the champions. Yes. This is kind of your base pledge. And I'm assuming, does this include all your Kickstarter goals as well?
Yes, that includes all of our stretch goals.
So if you just want to get
funding quests.
Yeah, yes.
Thanks, Manny. Funding quests.
So if you just want to get into the game, you want, you know, the 7 plus whatever is unlocked with our funding quests. This is all you're paying for. It's $59. You're getting, right now, 7 sets of dice, 7 sets of cards, 7 trays, 7 sets of dials. Each character has 2 different dials. 7 player boards, which are now trifold boards, you said?
Yes.
All of that for $60. It's like $9-ish, less than that per character. Not a bad deal. Then you have your Mirror Match bundle, which is this exact same thing, but doubled. So you can now play, you know, the same character against themselves. You're just getting 2 copies of the game. Then we have...
Yeah, or gift it. So we had in our first one, a lot of people bought that to gift it as well, because that, if you go to that tier, not only does the price go down just slightly, but more importantly, shipping is totally free. So a lot of people like that.
Oh, so price actually goes down quite a bit if that's the case. So $59 plus shipping versus $115, which is already a savings of $7, I believe. And then you get free shipping on top of that. Yeah, that's a pretty good deal. Buy one, give one to a friend. And then we start getting into the fun levels. And this is usually where I end up dropping things. So I'm like, if I'm going to do Kickstarter, I want everything. The Epic Collection, which is your $135 level, includes all of the Season 2 Champion Edition. So what we just talked about. 2 playmats. Now, you have a Season 1 and a Season 2 playmat. Now, these are just the 28 by 15 inch-ish playmats, and they're art for... They're like ensemble art, I guess?
It's an ensemble, yeah. So it's like all the heroes plus the Mad King for that season.
But it doesn't have any like spaces. You don't need... Because everything's on your board right now that you lay out. It's just kind of a mat that you can roll out and... One person has one half of it and one person has the other half. Is that the idea there?
No, you take up a good portion of it by yourself.
Okay.
On one.
But you get 2 of them in this pledge, so
Yep.
That works out. You also get card sleeves for, looks like, every character for both seasons. Am I reading this correctly? So yes, card sleeves for all season one heroes and all season two heroes. That's 50 card sleeves per hero, which is way more than you need. It's enough to spare.
Yes, it is.
And then the battle chest box. Describe this a little bit, because this one is a little unclear. You get a box, but now you also get another box with this pledge.
So the battle chest. So we did not initially plan on putting a battle chest in this campaign. When we set out to do season two, we ended up talking with our publisher, our distributor, about the retail plan and the forward, you know, that 10-year plan kind of thing. And one of the outcomes of it was the idea of these two-hero battle boxes. Easier entry point for a person to come into the game. A quick and easy way for new people to be like, oh man, I want the Huntress and the Tactician. So I'm going to spend $20. I'll buy this box or whatever that price ends up being. But there were also a lot of fans who are like, but I want one box to hold them all. And we're like, okay, well, let's explore this. You know, there, you have a box for season one. That's great. What if we gave people a box that could hold all 8 of season two? And so Gavin came up with an idea as to how we could house these things inside this box. And then also we're going to add 6 trays. Because the trays are going to change just a little bit from season one to season two. But 6 new trays, so you could take your components from season one and mix and match inside this larger box. And so it's a way to store those 8 if you want. I mean, it's also a way to mix and match 8 heroes into one box.
So this box will store all 8 of the heroes from season two.
Exactly, yes.
Got it.
It will. And one of the questions that we frequently get is, well, why not 14 heroes? So I can put all of season one and all of season two in there. And yep. I mean, just keep going down that rabbit hole, right? Yeah. I mean, as we get to 50 heroes, are you really going to carry a suitcase with you to game night? You know, and all these, no, you're not. And I actually don't want that. You know, I want people to pick their battle box. Like, I'm going to take these 2 heroes, or maybe I'll take 2 of them, right? I'll bring my 4 favorite heroes to game night, and everyone else has got their favorite heroes, and we're going to just match. That's what I want it to be. And so this felt right that we can include a box for each season to hold that season. For the people who want to have just one game, you know, classic game to bring, they can still do that.
Excellent.
Yep.
So, yeah, I think there was one place on the Kickstarter page, I'm not seeing it now, that mentioned 6 spaces for it, which I'm assuming meant when you only had 6 heroes, it would fit 6. But if you add 2 more, you're going to increase the box so it fits all 8 of those heroes.
Yeah, so we haven't revealed all the details of it yet, so I have to be careful what I say here. But basically, Gavin is working on a very creative design so that the box, if you only have 6 heroes in it, it'll work just great. And if you have 8 in it, it will also work just great. So it's a very clever design.
Excellent. I look forward to it. All right, and now we get to the Legendary Collector. Bundle and save, include all season 1 and season 2. So this is really, if you missed out on the first season, you can get everything that was in season 1. You get everything in season 2. You get the playmats. You get all the sleeves. You get the battle chest. You get all of the extra funding quests. And it looks like if I was to add all this together, so the total of this is $170. But if I was to add all this together, it seems like this is a pretty darn good deal for everything you're getting in this.
Yeah, so it's the total price is $245 plus shipping, and it's multiple waves of shipping. So, I mean, you're easily pushing, I don't know, $270 probably or something. And we're doing it for $170, and it's free shipping.
Yeah, $170 with free shipping, which is crazy because you're looking at that point. I'm doing quick math in my head, 14 characters. So even it's 14 characters sleeved in a nice carrying case with playmats just added on. But even if you just look at those 14 characters, you're looking at maybe, what, $11, $12 a character with sleeves and the playmats thrown in. And yeah, this is the one that I'm going to be backing. So, and I already have the first season, which is the crazy part. But now I can have another one to give away. So that's my plan.
Well, awesome. You know what's interesting about that is, so our first one had the retail edition and it had the champion edition, our first Kickstarter. And the champion edition had the swirl dice, which the fan response to swirl dice has been over the top. People again and again and again say how much they love those beautiful swirl dice. And those do not come in our retail edition of season 1. So we did a very small reprint specifically of those Kickstarter editions And right now, the only way to get that is to back at the Legendary Collector. So I think that's further motivated people to, even if they already have the game, like, well, shoot, man, I'll keep it, give it away, sell it, whatever. Like, this is one of the few ways to get it.
Yep. And this is a limited quantity. So right now, as we record, it's 760 left of 1,500 total. So if you're interested in this, go back this now, because that may not be there at the end of the campaign when everyone's rushing in to grab this stuff. So
it's true.
All right. And you are still, you're targeting November for season two. Now that you have Roxley behind you, do you feel like that's a legitimate date? Like, you have a plan? This isn't your first, you know, time around the block. So it seems like this is probably a pretty realistic date.
Yes, it is. So our first campaign, we said November, and again, we were brand new at that time. And we, for a portion of our audience, we missed that date by about 3 weeks, which I felt fine about, frankly. But this time, I feel like we know now what all the hiccups are. We're aware of the Chinese holidays we have to schedule in. Yes. We know what kind of things can slow us down. So I feel pretty darn confident that we'll not be later than that.
Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, you guys were definitely on time. Anything in Kickstarter, you know, plus or minus a month, and usually it's not minus a month, is the exact same thing. Like, okay, you hit your estimate spot on.
Yep.
So was not disappointed to see this come in, and it's like, yeah, no, it's great. Anything else you want to add? Anything I missed and you're like, oh, wait, there's a cool thing that I must tell you about? Or not.
we've covered pretty much everything. I think there's some exciting reveals. Manny will be releasing a free downloadable PDF in the very near future for a comic book. So that'll be really fun to share. We have the funding quest. Of course, we can't talk about them right now, but there's some exciting stuff that we have not yet revealed coming down on the funding quest as well. So yeah, and then lastly, I really emphasize, please go check out the community.dicethrone.com. It's a phenomenal place. It's a very, very positive place. We don't tolerate anything, you know, the toxicness that in a lot of other gaming communities, sadly. And so it's a really great atmosphere.
All right. Well, I will put all of these links in the show notes. So if you're listening to this, just scroll down and you'll see the links to the Kickstarter, the links to the Dice Throne homepage, to the community page. I may even throw in a link to a couple reviews. I know that I just watched the one Tom Vassell did for you guys, and you know, he raving about things. So if you're on the fence, this game, I think this game is for everybody. You don't have to be into fantasy. You don't have to be into dueling. You don't have to be into like free-for-alls. Don't have to scare you. This game really is a great gamer level casual ish game. And I only say casual because it gets in those casual gamers. It also, the hardcore gamers, there's a lot of game here for the hardcore gamers as well. And I think this bridges the gap in a way that not a lot of games can do.
Yep. Agreed.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's really been cool to be a part of this show.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming on. I may have to have you on again when you're season three, or when all of the stretch goals are out. I might shoot you an email being like, okay, that was really, really cool. So you won't hear the last of me.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks again for coming on the show.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to another Tabletop Game Talk Side Chat. If you enjoyed this podcast, check out our weekly show if you don't already. It's available wherever you find your podcasts, on YouTube, and at the tabletopgametalk.com website. Until next time, keep playing games and having fun.